This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. This month's podcast with professors is with Debbie Felton, professor of classics and undergraduate program director at UMass Amherst. She's the author and editor of many books which focus on antiquity, folktales, the supernatural, and the monstrous. Today we discuss her latest book, Monsters and Monarchs, Serial Killers in the Classical Myth and History.
I think your topic is so fascinating. I'm really looking forward to talking about it. And, you know, surely you get the same reaction whenever you tell people what you do. They're like, ooh, cool. I want to hear more. But you really go into the ideas of serial killers and ancient serial killers. So I guess the first place to start off is kind of, I always say we should begin with definitions, you know. Sure. What exactly is a serial killer? And I mean, you've written about it for your book that it's sort of often considered a modern phenomena, but that it's not. So I was wondering why people thought it was a modern phenomena and also why it's not.
Okay.
So it's like a two-parter there.
Sure. No, I mean, this is the reason I wrote the book in the first place. So when I first suggested to colleagues that I might want to research serial killers in the ancient world, there was a lot of skepticism. It's like, you must be kidding. Like, there weren't such a thing. It's not possible, et cetera, et cetera. And that may just be because there aren't any sort of overt, obvious cases along the lines that we think of these days, like the 60s and 70s and 80s, where we saw a lot of the more well-known ones like John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy, et cetera. So there was no sort of in your face, this is clearly a serial killer at work here. But it's the term or the phrase serial killer didn't really come into use until the 1980s. So it's a pretty modern term itself. And, you know, previously there wasn't a lot of thought among criminologists and psychologists about distinguishing among things like mass murders and what we now call serial killings and just other sorts of multiple murders, I guess, is how I would say it. And over the last few decades, the FBI, which has a crime classification manual, it's like CCM, okay, which is sort of like the DSM for psychology, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual. They keep updating it. So the crime classification manual, over the decades, increasingly breaks down types of serial killer and what their motivations are and how they might be characterized. But even the definition, to get back to your question here, the definition keeps shifting. Also, so about as recently as maybe about a decade ago, the definition of a serial killer was someone who kills three or more victims in different places, not at their house. And then still there'd be a sort of psychological breakdown for motives. But more recently, that has been reduced to someone who kills at least two separate people, preferably in two different events, but possibly in the same event, like the Zodiac Killer killed, you know, or at least tried to kill two at once, and sometimes did actually kill two at once. So they're still refining their, like the FBI is still refining its definitions along with sort of cooperation with other law enforcement agencies, because the FBI isn't the only one out there that's trying to define serial killer. They're just sort of one of the biggest ones. So, you know, for these definitions that originally included kills, you know, in different places, well, what about people like John Wayne Gacy or Jeffrey Dahmer, who brought people home and killed them at home, or Peter Sutcliffe in the UK? I mean, they're just clearly stipulating that the killings had to be away somewhere, was already not working, for example. And then there's, what if somebody kills, you know, two people and is prevented from killing a third, but was about to? Are they still a serial killer? You know, so it's very, very hard to make it sort of black and white categories or black and white definitions in terms of the breakdown. But hopefully you get the general idea. It's someone who kills more than one person. I think part of the important part is like by the same sort of method and maybe with the same, you know, the same motivation, the same signature or modus operandi. So it's not just the number, it's the method of killing and the motivation behind it. And that's the sort of thing that can be really difficult to find in antiquity because you don't have forensic evidence, right? So you're not going to pinpoint someone's, someone leaves like, you know, a little sign of the cross at a crime scene or something, you know, so you're not going to find that sort of signature, for example. And the other thing that I just want to say is that my study, and I guess I could just hold it up here. So this is the book, and you can see it's, you know, it's a trade paperback, really. So I want to make it clear that this isn't an academic monograph. So it's not written for a specialized audience. It really is. It's more broad than deep in terms of a general discussion that non-specialists could, I hope, understand. So I was really just looking for evidence of the sort of crimes that we associate with serial killers. Like, can we find that sort of description in antiquity? And I was kind of surprised when I did. Because I had read in all of these books that it was a modern thing. Like, people tended to blame it on the ills of modern society, especially capitalism and overindulgence and decadence and all of that sort of thing. So that's why there was this tendency to think of it as modern. Sorry, that was a very long-winded way of getting around to both parts.
No, and I asked you like three questions in a row. But it's so interesting. I mean, maybe just to get back to the first part, why is location matter?
Well, I'm not sure why they considered why the law enforcement agencies initially considered location as something to try to narrow down. It may be because initially, when they started recognizing serial killing as a phenomenon, usually the victims were found away from home, and it wasn't until they started finding more murderers who actually were keeping the bodies at home, like Jeffrey Dahmer or John Wayne Gacy. It wasn't until they started seeing, this happens a lot also, and a lot is relative, right? Because serial killers are still fairly rare, as far as we know. But so initially it would be like, these bodies of hitchhikers were found along the river or the highway or that sort of thing. And they were killed by similar methods. So maybe one person is behind it. So it was a question of sort of starting to piece all of the information together once a definition of what a serial killer might be started to coalesce in the 1980s. And this was already after some of the earlier examples. Basically in the 70s, you started having, I think that's when you had Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy and the Zodiac working in the 70s and 80s. And so that's why in the 80s, people started to pay more attention. More things were coming to light. And that had to do with the spread of media also. There was more communication among law enforcement agencies getting started. And it's not all just in the US. There were examples in Germany and the UK, for example, Jack the Ripper maybe being the most famous or infamous in the modern period anyway.
I went to the University of Edinburgh. And so, you know, you do the ghost tours and you always hear, and there was quite famous serial killer duo there, if I recall. They used to like kind of run a hostel, and they would sell the bodies to the cadavers to the university to dissect them. And they used to do this tactic. That sounds right. I remember one would hold the chin, the other one would put their fingers in their nose so they would suffocate them, but without leaving any marks. So that, and they only got caught when they accidentally killed a very well-known prostitute who was recognized by the students.
Oh, dear. Those might be that sounds familiar. I think it might have been Burke, and I may be getting the names wrong, but Burke and Hare, they, the ones who supplied cadavers, like they ran out of graves to rob and they started, you know, providing their, something along those lines, if I'm remembering right. There's just sadly so many, you know, to keep track of.
Pretty dark. I mean, I guess I always wonder if, like, historically, if you had the, let's say, inclination to be very murderous, you could get that out in any war scene, like battle scene. Like, there was enough opportunity to basically be a serial killer in battle without, you know, you think of like Achilles making the rivers run with blood, you know, the people didn't have to do it separately.
yes and no. I would say to that, depending on, because it's part of the part of what they're trying to do with defining serial killer is get at the motivation. So you can be bloodthirsty, and you can, if you're put in a war situation, a martial situation, you could be very, you know, bloody and violent. But is it something you would do outside of that context? Like, once you're done with that, it seems like more people end up with PTSD instead of feeling like they want to come back and continue doing that. On the other hand, it is one of the things that the FBI thinks about. Well, are people like hired assassins, for example, are those, or people, you know, mafia hitmen, are those people who are sort of sublimating their serial killer impulses by doing it more, you know, legitimately, I shouldn't laugh, as a job, or someone like Locusta of Gaul in antiquity, who was a poisoner by trade, and she was a famous poisoner, and people knew she was a poisoner, and she supplied poisons to the imperial family, for example. We don't know if she poisoned people on her own, but, you know, she was clearly willing to supply poisons for, you know, in order for people to be killed. So are people like that kind of, like you say, getting their impulses out by redirecting them? One of the first questions I was asked, actually, when I started on this was, well, what about war? You know, aren't people in wartime serial killers, or they have serial killer impulses? But the motivation seems to be very different. And I mean, you know, you've got, like, say, Herodotus's description of the Scythians, where they don't just kill the enemy, they take their skulls and turn them into drinking cups and that sort of thing. So they're taking trophies. But that's more of sort of a community reaction to, we conquered our enemies. And it isn't quite the same as, I need to have, like, individual power control over one person who represents my abusive mother or father, for example, if you see what I mean in terms of motivation. So I was initially asked, well, what about war? And I think, you know, if people were to look at the crime classification manual, they'd see some real differences there. But, you know, again, it wouldn't be surprising if, you know, you have some people doing both, like people go off to war, decide they do want to keep doing it, or they enlist in the army, maybe so that they can redirect their impulses. But overall, they're very, very different reasons.
Yeah, I guess it's really strange to think, like, just because you're getting paid to do something doesn't mean you don't like it. You know what I mean? That, yes. That with regards to, say, at assassins, and, you know, yeah. There was like a popular TV show called Killing Eve. I don't know if you saw that one.
I'm familiar with it, even though I didn't watch it, but yes, I did read about it.
It was a good pandemic show, because she traveled a lot around Europe. So if you were kind of aching to be traveling, it was, you know, travel porn in that regard. But it was one of those, she was good at it, and so she enjoyed it, and she made money at it, and so yes, she was paid to do it, but you get the feeling that the payment was just the cream on top, you
right
know?
That was gravy, right? So you get to do something you want to do anyway. I think the difference there would be, again, still with the difference with serial killers, is that from what I understand, and again, here's my disclaimer, I'm not a psychologist or a criminologist. I don't have that background. I read up a bit, but I still, you know, I'm not qualified. I don't have degrees in those fields. But the motivation seems to be an important factor, that if you're assigned to kill certain people, they're not necessarily the sort of targets you would pick yourself. You know, if you need to demonstrate power over women because, you know, you have misogynistic serial killer tendencies for various reasons. So instead of picking on prostitutes, say like Jack the Ripper, you have to go out and kill, you know, somebody's political opponent or whatever. It may not quite satisfy the urges. So again, that's not to say there isn't overlap in all of these areas, because it's, like I say, the FBI and everybody is still sort of you know, noticing how it's difficult to break down into very discrete categories. And it depends how much psychological information you can gather about a serial killer if and when you capture one. Are they going to tell the truth? I mean, that's the other thing. You can interview somebody like, you know, John Wayne Gacy. Is he going to actually tell you the truth when a psychologist is sitting there asking him questions, or a law enforcement person is saying, why did you do this? You know, you don't know if they're even telling you anything that you can use to make a legitimate psychological study. but it's still, you know, even if they're lying, that maybe tell you something, you know, about their motivations or their thoughts.
Now, what I thought was really interesting in your book is that you talk about historical serial killers, but also mythological ones. And I think that was sort of an interesting juxtaposition to take this kind of concept of a serial killer and put it mythologically. So maybe you could bring up a few of your top favorite mythological and historical serial killers. Give everybody a taste for some of the selection.
Sure. No, that's a great question. And a sort of a disclaimer again, there are, you know, potential methodological problems in terms of grabbing a historical one and saying, oh, look, it's similar to a mythological one. When you're taking things out of their textual contexts, did that make sense? When you're taking them out of context, you know, you might be missing some, you know, aspects of what this or that author is doing. But my goal with this particular study was just to look for evidence of serial killing in antiquity in general, and not specifically say what Tacitus might be doing or Suetonius with their portraits of Nero. But Nero is an example I like to bring up from antiquity, not because he was necessarily a serial killer, but because those authors and others describe him in terms that make him sound to us like a serial killer, now that we know what serial killers are these days. So because I've mentioned that one of the things that helps identify serial killers in modern times is psychological motivation. And what we have for Nero is some very interesting background information on his childhood and upbringing that kind of sounds very similar to what we have heard about some of the serial killers that I've mentioned. So Nero, for example, abandoned by his father at a very young age, distant mother Agrippina, not there for a lot of time, and apparently didn't care so much when she was around. He was raised by household servants who probably had no business raising a child. And you know, so he started acting up from a very young age, according to people like biased historians like Tacitus and Suetonius and one or two others. So, you know, they describe him as committing crimes before he, you know, becomes emperor. He would start bar fights. He would hit people over the head and crack their skulls. He supposedly murdered people and threw their bodies in the Tiber, you know, that sort of behavior. He, you know, sexually attacked people and in short got away with a lot of crimes, which begs the question, well, if people knew about them, why weren't they doing anything about them? But even then, you know, part of the imperial family there. And then by the time he was emperor, he was hiring people like Locusta to poison Britannicus and, well, Claudius. Agrippina was behind that too, according to these authors. So the psychological background with the absent father, the distant sort of unaffectionate mother whose affection he was always trying to gain. I mean, obviously there are a lot of people in that situation. The majority of them do not become serial killers, but it's almost as if, you know, it is as if, especially once you get the description of his violent behavior and that it increases, he continues to get away with it and it gets worse and worse. That's the sort of thing you see with someone like Jeffrey Dahmer. I don't think we have descriptions of Nero torturing small animals or setting fires necessarily, but there's that pattern of, something already wrong at a very young age and increasingly violent acts, you know, getting drunk. With Jeffrey Dahmer, it was drugs and alcohol. I mean, just all sorts of things like that. So again, this isn't to say that Nero was a serial killer. I mean, if you've got somebody who's like emperor and they're out in the open, they can do some of this with impunity, at least for a while. You know, we're not dealing with your typical serial killer who is generally private and you don't find out this stuff until they're caught and thrown in jail, kind of. But the point seems to be more that the ancient authors were familiar with this kind of behavior and this kind of pattern that would lead to someone being a killer. So they are describing Nero in terms that are intentionally trying to make him into this kind of criminal, even if he wasn't one. And so to us, he sounds a bit like a serial killer. And the mythological example, then, if you want me to go into that one, one of I think the easiest ones to look at is Procrustes in the Theseus story. So Procrustes was, I think, the last one that that these two ran into in Procrustes. Again, this is so typical of so many more modern stories. He had a like ramshackle, you know, little hut or inn just off the road on the way to, you know, from the Peloponnese to Athens. And as we find out, his habit is he's supposedly a robber, right? But he's not like described, like the robbing isn't the point of the stories. You don't hear, oh, and he just took their sack of gold and built a better house for himself or something. What you hear about is that he would take in, you know, travelers, like, you know, vulnerable travelers. And if they were too long for his bed, he would cut off their limbs to make them fit the bed. And if they were too short, depending which variant of the myth you reread, right? Because there's multiple variants. If they were too short for the bed, he would hammer their legs to pulp so that he could then stretch them out, like, you know, broken bones and all that, stretch them out to fit his bed. So what you've got there with Procrustes is basically what might be called a murder kit, like Ted Bundy had and Peter Sutcliffe had, or if anyone's watching, you know, if anyone's familiar with the fictional Dexter on TV, the murder kit of surgical tools. So Procrustes had at minimum probably a hammer and a saw, and maybe a couple other things in there. And it sounds like he, you know, tied his guests down on the bed. So maybe he had some rope. And this was a very specific ritualistic method of killing. And then there's the bed there. And is that some sort of a subliminal psychosexual element that we don't want to overinterpret, but we also don't want to underinterpret, right? Because it's not like we get background on Procrustes like we do for somebody like Nero, for example. There's just not enough filled in there. You know, and a bunch of the other people that Theseus meets, like Chiron or Periphetes, they are also, you know, essentially serial killers in terms of, you know, targeting multiple people over a long time period, killing them by the same method, until Theseus puts a stop to it by killing. Theseus is sort of like Dexter, he kills the criminals. But unlike the criminals in antiquity, Theseus purifies himself from the bloodshed, and he is, you know, seen as an Athenian hero rather than as, you know, a criminal for killing criminals. The laws sort of allowed that in different ways.
Yeah, that's gotta be a weird element too, then, people who think that they're doing like God's work, or they're thinking that it's a ritual purified, like if they think that they're doing a good thing, like they're still killing several people.
Yeah. So I think at least that dynamic was different in antiquity as opposed to something like what Dexter, the fictional Dexter, is doing. But that also depends on your point of view. I mean, Theseus was an Athenian hero. And if you look at some of the other people that he met, they're like the king of their local areas. Procrustes, not so much, but some of the others were. And so the king of Eleusis, for example, is someone that he kills, who I think is the one who, one of the characters, because Heracles runs across this sort of character too, but the king of Eleusis, I think, wrestles people until he kills them. And the Eleusinians are like, well, he was trying to defend us from outsiders. And then this Theseus comes along and kills him. Theseus is the criminal. So the perspective is important also, but it's not like, you know, Eleusis left a ton of written records talking about this situation. We get the Athenian perspective for something like that, and for some of the other ones as well. Like Heracles, for example, Theseus's older cousin in myth, he, aside from his 12 labors, has a lot of these side adventures where he runs into local kings or, you know, strongmen who are basically killing foreigners who are seen as trespassing. And Heracles comes and he kills these people who are essentially defending their own territory, but it's put in ways that, you know, where we are supposed to sympathize and empathize with Heracles rather than with the local, you know, with Antaeus, who wrestles people to the, you know, until they're dead. So the perspective is important, and we just don't get other than the victors.
It's really interesting too, because, like, you know, I've been doing a lot of different podcasts recently with different professors about, you know, the value in folk tales and mythology, and like the importance and details and how they kind of have other meanings that because they survive this sort of long period of time that resonates with people. And so, you know, I'm thinking about other fairy tales or folk tales that involve serial killers, like Hansel and Gretel, for instance, is like a pretty dark story. I mean, and there's like plenty of these that we even have in our more recent mythologies and folk tales. So it's interesting, you know, of course, there's nothing new under the sun. It shouldn't be surprising that serial killers exist. I guess what I wonder, what is the value of having these serial killers featured in mythology and in folk tales? Like, what's their purpose to exist? Why would they care or write about it rather than maybe just scaring children?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly were stories intended to scare children. And before I directly address the question, I don't know if you know, but I also published a book on cultural history of fairy tales last summer.
I think I saw that. So I was thinking about you actually when I was like thinking about fairy tales, because I was like, you'll have some interesting insights on that.
Well, and Graham Anderson at the University of Kent at Canterbury actually has done quite a lot on folktales in the ancient world. And of course, Bill Hansen, retired from Indiana, is one of the main folklore in classical literature people, along with Adrian Mayer out at Stanford. But yeah, so why have characters like this? And again, they wouldn't have considered them as serial killers specifically with that terminology, but as villains. And with somebody like Theseus and Heracles too, for that matter, part of what they seem to be doing is making the roads safe for society or something along those lines. One of the things I've looked into is this whole serial killing on the roads, because obviously it's one of the areas where a lot of serial killing happens even today is on highways, because there's this huge level of anonymity. And I mean, there's, you know, apparently a lot of truck drivers, I shouldn't say a lot, but there's a percentage of serial killers, which is, again, not a big percentage of overall murderers, but there's a good number of them. There are a good number who are truck drivers, and still killing, you know, prostitutes are still a big target along very long highway routes. And it's almost impossible to find the killers. So the roads seem to be one of these factors. And that in antiquity, at the time when you've got Heracles and then his younger cousin Theseus wandering around, what you're seeing is, I think, an expansion of Greek life outside of their little enclaves. Like, there's more communication between, you know, the Greek polis, the Greek city-states. There's more communication between the Greek city-states. And there's more trade starting with other areas around the Mediterranean, even farther east. So there's a certain anxiety about opening up borders. I mean, we can see this today, too, in terms of trade. There's a certain concern about foreigners, their customs. Does this mean we have to change our way of life? Is it going to affect, how is it going to affect our culture? And so there's this sort of anxiety about foreigners in general from fairly insulated, you know, Greek societies. I mean, they're isolated geographically to a large extent, with mountains, rivers, you know, valleys, etc. But then there's also the traveling on the roads aspect itself, because you're going long distances. It's not like there were police forces patrolling the roads. So, and basically road bandits, like robbers on the road, were a definite concern. And it's not like they necessarily all killed whoever they were robbing. A lot of them just robbed people, but some of them also killed people, whoever they were robbing. And so traveling on the roads was not seen as a super secure type of travel, unless you were in a huge group, which was not very often the case. Women would be told not to wear their jewelry, you know, nothing flashy. It was even a bigger concern during the Roman Empire than, say, in the mythological times that I'm mentioning with Heracles and Theseus. It was an actual historical problem in the Roman Empire. Bandits were all over the place. The empire was too big for the Roman troops to patrol. So there were some apparently pretty infamous real life bandits that they never necessarily even caught. But that's one of the reasons. So that's one of the reasons why you might have characters like this in the stories.
It's so funny that the idea of a highwayman. Actually, when I was a little girl, I lived in England for a while in a house called Burhill Cottage in Chobham, England, and it was famous for having the ghost of Dick Turpin.
Oh, you're kidding me! Oh,
he was because it was this house. My dad was a bit of a romantic when he went and found this really breaking down, crumbling 16th century, you know, cottage. And my mother was like, I have to do so many repairs on it. But yeah, even my whole life, if anything went missing, we'd say, well, it was the ghost of Dick Turpin. You know, the highwayman followed us wherever we
went. Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much the most famous highwayman, you know, outside of Robin Hood, if you consider Robin Hood a highwayman.
And it's interesting to think of like the path and saying, like, that's another one, like Little Red Riding Hood, you know, the amount of times a story has like, stay on the path, don't go into the woods, don't get lost. That's sort of reiterated again and again. And that's like the kind of place that the moral of the story always is leading the path away, you'll find danger.
Don't engage with strangers, that kind of thing. Don't engage with strangers. And then, you know, another reason, maybe, as I was sort of alluding to, that when you have someone you want to make a Pan-Hellenic hero, or someone you want to make an Athenian hero like Theseus, even the kings of other Greek city-states can be, you know, put, it's sort of like what Tacitus and Suetonius did with Nero. Let's just make him sound like a real bad guy, even if he wasn't nearly as bad as we're painting him. Yeah.
Well, and so speaking of Tiberius and then Nero, like your title is Monsters and Monarchs. So I think that's a really interesting component, because obviously people don't necessarily think monarchs are monsters, but are there a lot of monarchs who were murderers? A question I regularly think of, especially whenever I go into the Julio-Claudian dynasty, is, you know, is there something in becoming a king or a queen that makes you a killer?
Well, this too has to do with the differences in motivations and definitions, depending on, again, how modern our definition do we want to use. Someone like Tiberius, he ordered the execution of a huge number of people, and he didn't feel good about it, but he was paranoid, you know, and he wanted to hold on to his power. And in the case of rulers, monarchs, a lot of them, they can, you know, order tons of executions, they can, you know, a lot of which seem unfair, etc. But the motivations are not necessarily the same ones we would impute to what we think of as serial killers. So paranoia about someone overthrowing you is really different. And sure, they can abuse their power. But in terms of that making them serial killers with, say, a ritual method, killing people themselves with their own hands, which is something that these sources are saying Nero did do, which is, you know, makes him different from, say, Tiberius. And you'll notice I'm not even touching Caligula here, because he's just beyond the pale. I mean, that's clearly a whole different issue. So the motivations behind the killings. And so, you know, you've got abusive rulers like, you know, Periander of Corinth, for example, and you've got to consider the bias in their sources, among other things, because a lot of Greek authors, for example, were maybe more pro-democracy in terms of what early democracy was like, as opposed to having a tyrant like Periander around. So there were shifts going on in that time, like 5th century, in a lot of the Mediterranean world, shifts from single rulers to more democratic forms of government that can play into how the authors, you know, describe autocrats, I suppose. But then the other thing is how many of these kings kill by themselves. And that's why in mythology, we find more of these kings and rulers being described in what we might think of as more serial killer terms, like the king of Eleusis, for example, or the king of Bebrycia that Jason and the Argonauts met, and that was on the edges of the Black Sea, so not even Greek, but he would, you know, basically challenge visitors to boxing matches and beat the crap out of them until they were a bloody pulp. So we've got kings, certain kings, who are described in those terms, as opposed to, so they want to kill with their own hands, for example, as opposed to just ordering masses of executions. And then there are the in-between cases where they're enjoying it a little too much. So it's sort of a gradient rather than black and white instances of But that's why monarchs is in the title. It's not just for the alliteration. It's because of how some of these monarchs are painted as monstrous, having monstrous behavior.
Yeah, just I think of some of the more famous female serial killers as well. And wasn't there an interesting one, I want to say, in Romania?
Oh, are you thinking of Elspeth Bathory?
Yeah, the one she had a torture chamber at the bottom, and she would like torture her servants and things like that, and definitely sounded like she enjoyed it too much.
Yeah, if it's the one I think you're thinking of, she wanted to bathe in the blood of virgins to keep herself young. And so she would, you know, torture and kill these servant girls from poor families. Basically, she'd buy them from their families to be her servant girls. And the families were, yeah, sure, give us the money. Yeah, I shouldn't be so glib about all of this because it's all pretty horrible. But yeah, so she would kill the, you know, servant girls so that she could bathe in their blood. When she ran out of servant girls, she started inviting the daughters of the aristocracy, but when they started disappearing, huh, what a surprise, people started paying more attention, and she was finally caught. So that may be the one you're thinking of, but yes, she absolutely didn't just, you know, have people drain these girls' blood for her. She apparently, you know, did a lot of it herself and did enjoy torturing them during the process of draining them.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, there's plenty of castles you can wander around in Europe and they have, you know, all sorts of torture equipment. I wonder if part of the difficulty in discovering about ancient serial killers is that at different times or different cultures have a different level of value for human life. So as you say, like for most of antiquity, if you killed a servant or a slave, you know, you probably wouldn't have even been considered a serial killer amongst your peers if you were at least killing slaves, you know, in their mentality. Yeah. And sadly, that probably would have been true even in early American history with slavery as well. So yeah. The tricky thing is, I wonder if the term serial killer only happens once we like give value to everybody's life.
That's a really good point. And that's one of the things that the CCM tries to deal with. I mean, it's not, they haven't, I think, sufficiently dealt with the issues like you mentioned, like slavery in this country. But in antiquity, it would have been even harder to say, oh, that's it. Like, it's not necessarily even defined as murder, you know, in ancient Athens, if you kill property, right? So on the other hand, the Athenians, you know, had an entirely separate court where they could try things like inanimate objects, like the roof tile. Like if a roof tile falls off of a is loose and falls off a building and kills someone, that roof tile could be put on trial, just so that the family would feel better. And like there's an acknowledgement that, you know, there was a death and a loss here, and then the roof tile would be exiled, you know, by being thrown over the border into Boeotia or something like that. So yeah, they're really, I mean, but that's again, if like a citizen is killed, for example. So yeah, there was definitely different valuing of citizens versus slaves. And I think, you know, but that, you know, if the slaves were the killers, there was certainly a lot of attention paid to it. And I think what's more disturbing is that the slaves were often accused of killing when they probably hadn't, and were, you know, rounded up and executed, or forced to confess and then executed. So the treatment of citizens versus slaves definitely complicates the issue of, are we dealing with a serial killer or not, in terms of antiquity anyway.
Would you find much difference between ancient cultures? Like, would there have been between Athens and Sparta, for instance, or Thebes? Like, are there more serial killers in certain areas? I mean, I don't know if you can get into that much information.
Well, I think that's the problem, is we just have so much less information outside of Athens and Rome. Well, I mean, for the Roman Empire, we've got, you know, more records from across the empire, but for Greece, it's especially hard to, outside of mythology anyway, it's very difficult to find anything historical like we have with Tacitus and Suetonius for the Roman emperors. So in terms of Greece, outside of, say, Herodotus, you really don't have a lot of information about anything outside of Athens. Herodotus fortunately has a, you know, a broader view, but what we see are the cases in war, for example, or tyrants, like I keep mentioning Periander because he's one of the more well-known abusive tyrants who at least mistreated his citizens horribly, if not, you know, actually killing a lot of them through weird ways. So it's difficult to say for Sparta or Thebes. And of course, Sparta had a very sort of different ethos in terms of being a more martial society and separating out the men and the women and training them differently. But yeah, we just don't have as many records to go by.
If they had if the Spartans were killing Helots, for instance, then maybe that wouldn't have been recorded, as we were saying before, but different classes of citizens or lack thereof being a citizen. But I'm interested too about how kind of studying ancient serial killers, both the real and the mythological, would help us understand serial killers today. Like, do we learn more about them from the studies? Are like a practical element to learning about ancient murderers?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, a really good question, and it's sort of one of the ones that got me started on looking into this in the first place. It's not like I have a personal obsession with serial killers or anything like that, but in various readings that I would just come across these statements like Jack the Ripper is the first modern serial killer, or the first serial killer, period. And it's only because of industrialized society and capitalism. And I think I mentioned this earlier, the reasons that people were thinking there are suddenly more serial killers is that, people are more self-indulgent, more decadent society, there are fewer constraints. And particularly, I guess, in the 60s and 70s in America, people were being like, there was a lack of funding for mental aid, and so people were being let out of asylums, and it was thought that they were going around killing people, or that they people were not locked up who should have been was part of the attitude. So there were various aspects of modern society that were being blamed for like what appeared to be an uptick in serial killing, and we don't know for sure if it was an uptick. We just know that suddenly a lot are being discovered and reported, and again, like I said, the 60s and 70s in particular, with I keep mentioning the same people, but John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy and the Zodiac Killer, because they made National News Son of Sam also on the other side of the country. I'm from the West Coast, so I tend to some of those tend to stick with me a little better, but I mean, John Wayne Gacy was in Chicago, Jeffrey Dahmer was Minnesota, I think. Anyway, so all over the country. And part of it was, well, we're hearing about all these cases in the US and Britain. So what's going on there? Well, once China and the USSR started opening up their records, it was apparent that the same thing was going on there. So it couldn't just be, oh, the decadent society of the US, if you've got all of this going on in communist countries, for example. And once journalism became more open and some of these records became more available, it was clear that there's some, very similar phenomena going on in these other countries. And then people started looking at, oh, look, Australia and South America. And do we want to count, drug cartels in this? I mean, that, again, a different motivation there. But people disappearing and bodies being found. So it was slowly becoming clear that this was more of a worldwide phenomenon. And also that once you start looking at the elements like the ritualized aspects of serial killing, that it goes back much farther than people think. And there are certainly cases from medieval France and Germany. There's some notorious murderers who were not initially called serial killers, who really do seem, like they should be called serial killers now. They thought they were wolves, and they would go and attack people as if they themselves were wolves and attack people. And there are cannibalistic aspects to some of that. But yeah, so 14th, 15th century France and Germany had a few notable cases. And then, again, it depends on the accessibility of records, but it's clear there were some, medieval cases as well, earlier medieval cases.
I'm just thinking, just like as we're speaking about the ritualized murder that kind of exists throughout history, just about everywhere in the world. And like, you know, you go to Fiji and you still do the ceremony where you get the little bowl that is supposed used to be the skull because cannibalism was pretty recent there. Similarly though, in Norway, when you cheers, you say skull, because originally you were cheersing with the skull. And you think again in like Mexico and you think of the Aztecs, you know, there's like, is there something inherent in human nature that is about ritual death that we have always had, and that maybe it's weirder that we've moved away from it? Maybe I shouldn't be saying this.
I think that gets towards a different question, which is how do we as humans try to control things that are basically out of our control, like that everyone has to die? So if we give it some ritual aspects, it may be a method of not just acknowledging it, but of trying to exert a little bit of control. And I mean, I think we do still have ritual because there are funeral rituals, right? So that's,
but the funeral rituals don't involve us killing the person.
No.
Hopefully.
No. If you look at different cultures had different reasons, like you talk about the Aztecs, for example, and the human sacrifice and the hearts and all that, different reasons for trying to, some of these are fertility rituals. You can just think of, I think Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery. Spoiler alert on a several decades old story, but basically these townspeople stone somebody on a yearly basis to ensure the fertility of their crops. Or The Wicker Man, the Christopher Lee version, not the Nicolas Cage version, please. But you know,
important difference.
Yeah, like the Wicker Man, where this little island has had some crops fail, and they decide that they need to do a very ancient Celtic ritual that's described by Julius Caesar, actually, of burning a virgin. Caesar doesn't describe the virgin part, but in the movie, you know, they have to burn a virgin to ensure the fertility of the crops or have a better season coming up. So it's sort of like, will the gods be pleased if we sacrifice something important to us? Will they give us something important back? So there are a lot of different reasons for that sort of killing, which is, again, more of a ritualized community killing that has a very different motivation from what the FBI would call serial killing.
We have to finish up, sadly, but I would like to maybe leave on one last question. Who do you think was the most surprising serial killer? You could be mythological as well. You're like, wow, yeah. I wouldn't have thought of that person.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm not sure about surprising. I think what maybe surprised me a little bit was reading some of the rationalizing versions from antiquity itself. Somebody like Polyphatus, I think 4th century BCE, don't quote me on that, but basically saying, of course, there cannot be such a monster as the Sphinx. That's just physiologically impossible. That must have been a bandit woman living in the caves of Mount Phicion and just coming down and killing young men and robbing them when they went in and out of the city. So what surprised me was the level of rationalization of myth that was going on even in antiquity, because I was not actually aware of the extent of that when I first went into this. And then some of these monsters seem like they're being described as serial killers. And it turns out that even in antiquity, there were some thoughts about that. Yeah.
Wow. I'm going to think of the Sphinx in a new light now.
Same type of victim, specific method of killing. So that sort of surprised me.
Well, thank you so much. And can you hold up your book one last time?
Sure. Well, thank you very much.
I love the cover.
Thank you for having me. I really like the sort of mugshot cover that they came up with, but thank you very much for having me. It's always nice to sort of talk about, you know, hopefully sort of general audience type of like classics for the general audience rather than classics for the, you know, professors, which I mean, that's fine too, but it's nice to try to spread the word about how many similarities antiquity does have with modern culture and modern psychology, relevance for the modern world.
And just to show it's still really, really interesting. I think that people think sometimes it belongs in like a dusty library and you're like, no, this stuff's really fascinating. So I think you're doing an excellent job of showing some of the more a different angle of the classics that maybe people don't think of initially.
Yeah, I do the weird stuff. That's what I'm told. I do the weird stuff.